next speaker, when I asked him how I should introduce him, said, just tell them I'm a banker. Well, that seemed unnecessarily provocative. A banker being like Johnson's definition of a patron, someone who watches complacently while you drown, and once you've reached land, rushes up with unnecessary offers of assistance. Richard Allen is the exact opposite of that. He actually helped save the nation and indeed the West when it was struggling in the coils of a one-sided detente back in the 70s and early 80s. He helped to bring Ronald Reagan to power as an advisor on foreign policy at those times, as national security advisor in the early years of the administration. He helped to put in place the policies that Gerald Frost was appraising a moment ago of the military buildup, and indeed one of the most important decisions, namely the perhaps the maybe the single greatest foreign policy success of the Reagan administration, the placing of the missiles in Western Europe. From his position as a banker in the private sector today, he continues to be a voice of common sense on foreign policy in this country as a distinguished fellow of the Heritage Foundation, as the head of its Asian Studies Center, and as a national security advisor to the RNC. He's speaking this morning on the situation in Asia. With great pleasure, I ask Richard Allen to address us.
Thank you, John. A cruel and unusual punishment is having to listen to me twice within a span of 12 hours. Last night was a very festive and interesting occasion. Today, we speak of deep substance, and I'm somewhat chagrined that I suggested the reversing the order of speakers this morning so that you might hear Europe first. After all, we are in Philadelphia, and we are your centering place here in Philadelphia. But because the problems that Gerald was discussing are so terribly important, I felt that they ought to be first in line. The kinds of problems and opportunities that I had to discuss are somewhat less dismaying, but they are linked to the complex of difficulties that we face with our European partners and we face with the Soviet Union. And that cluster of problems, genuine, deep, real, threatening to our national security that Gerald mentioned, can only be our primary concern over the course of the next 4 years, 8 years as the case may be. I was asked to say a few words today about Asia, and I was musing on my credentials to be able to say something about Asia. It happens that about 3 weeks ago, I cleared customs in Japan. I count only the times that I clear customs for the 110th time in my 22 years of traveling to Asia. That in the face of my primary interest being in Europe, I wish that I had the opportunity to address the questions that Gerald had. I'm in Asia 6 or 8 times a year, and ever since late 1967, when Richard Nixon sent me on a mission to Asia, I prepared myself for eating Japanese food, convinced that the Japanese ate fish heads first. I prepared myself for my first trip to Korea, not knowing what to find. Went to the DMZ and had a look. Prepared myself for my first trip to Hong Kong at the height of the Cultural Revolution. Now, in the perspective of 22 years, I find the most extraordinary change, not just the change that one sees in the absence of being there 2 or 3 years, the change that one can detect, feel, sense, smell, touch in the course of weeks or months that punctuate one's visits. After more than 20 years in traveling to Asia, I think I'm finally beginning to figure it all out. I visit countries in the region, have discussions with many of the people who are in command and are shaping policies. I think I now know that the opportunity the United States has found in Asia is a genuine one. Whether we exploit it correctly or not, of course, the next few years will determine largely whether we'll succeed around the world. Some have said that the next century will be the century of the Pacific Basin, and certainly that is the area which major growth will take place. We can't, of course, focus only on that, and we don't. It's often said that the United States can't focus on more than one major complex of problems at a time, and perhaps that's true. For example, during the mid-1980s in the Reagan administration, our European partners began to become very concerned, sexually nervous, about the new attention that President Reagan and his administration focusing on the Pacific Basin. And oddly enough, of all of the smashing foreign policy successes of the Reagan administration, the only one that was never claimed completely, perhaps even partially, was the success of Reagan Pacific Basin policy. During the campaign and the years leading up to the campaign, I had the opportunity to talk to then Governor Reagan many times about his feelings about the Pacific Basin. He said to me on more than one occasion, "I want to make this Pacific Basin thing work." As a consequence, certain important decisions were taken at the very outset of the administration to put in motion and to emphasize the orientation that his administration would like to take vis-a-vis the Pacific Basin. 8 years later, the result was one of the most stunningly successful policies that one could possibly imagine. I'd like to review just a few of the highlights of those successes with you, and then views about what might occur in the future. The very first step that Ronald Reagan took when he came to office was to save the life of a famous Korean dissident called Kim Dae-jung. How he did this was through a series of stealthy and interesting measures that later visited upon the administration and will in the future even visit upon it more difficulties because of the misunderstanding of the initiative that was taken. Kim Dae-jung, a famous left-wing dissident in Korea, had been accused of sedition, and the Korean government decided to put him to death. As a consequence of certain actions that then-President-elect Reagan took during the interregnum transition period, he reached out to Koreans, stabilized the regime of then-President Chun Doo-hwan, now disgraced as a consequence of having misused his power, and I think misinterpreted the nature of his friendship with the United States and his personal relationship with President Reagan, who now sits in a monastery contemplating his evil deeds, reached out, stabilized the Korean regime, and with it stabilized not only the relationship of the United States to Korea, an important partner of us that sits in a very important corner of Northeast Asia, but also stabilized Korea's relationship with Japan, which is a relationship fraught with hatred, envy, and anger as a result of Japanese actions over most of the first half of the 20th century. By reaching out at the same time to the Japanese administrations, the successive Japanese administrations, the Reagan administration cleverly, step by step, put into place the basis for a successful Pacific Basin policy. President Reagan visited Japan, reaffirmed the nature of the alliance, received visits from Japanese prime ministers who made successive promises not only on security matters but also on trade and other matters that pertain between the United States and Japan, the most important relationship in the Pacific Basin and one of the most important relationships we maintain in any place in the world. That leaves aside the question of whether or not the Japanese are reliable or, for that matter, desirable allies over the long haul. That's a question to be put and to be answered perhaps in other circumstances. Take, for example, the present discomfiture of the Japanese government. We sit here in Philadelphia, Europe-oriented, but a Japanese prime minister sits in Tokyo today with a popularity rating of 9%, the lowest popularity rating of any prime minister ever achieved since recording began in 1947. That is as a result of a scandal that is worse than Watergate in Japanese terms, a bursting scandal that has unmasked the institutionalized corruption system. And now that his own future is in peril, to the extent that the Japanese prime minister may have to leave office, certainly will not be reelected when his term comes up again in a few months, the relationship between the United States and Japan may be deeply injured, perhaps irremediably so. At the same time, Mr. Gorbachev, who has been active on the front of Europe and recently in Latin America, has been very active in Asia as well. We would face a very difficult, indeed impossible situation if Mr. Gorbachev were now to offer to Mr. Takeshita, Prime Minister of Japan, in his moment of great difficulties, the prospect of returning or negotiating for the return of one or more of the four northern islands, known as the Kuril Islands. In a flash, Corbymania of the type that Gerald Frost described as taking place in Europe today would overtake Japan, and we would find the alliance between Japan and the United States seriously threatened by this wave of popularity that would be engendered. Gorbachev has the wherewithal, in a single stroke, to rescue Mr. Kishin. I don't mean to give him any ammunition by suggesting it here today, but if I were in his shoes, that is precisely what I would do, to put the United States on the defensive again. As a result of the actions taken in Korea, Korea has now become an economic miracle in its own right. What has happened there has been stunning success. The United States carefully guided Korea onto the rails of democracy, and an incipient democracy is functioning in that country today. At the same time, after the success of the 1988 Olympics, I might add, or say parenthetically, that those of you who were alert to the opportunity, you might have seen me and my 13-year-old daughter running the torch on opening day, just an hour before it went into the stadium. To talk about contrasts, one could reflect upon one's first visit to that country in 1967, when an attempt had just been made on the life of President Park, and when a curfew was imposed in Korea, a city where a two-story building was already a skyscraper. To compare today of the Korea that you saw, we all saw, during the 1988 Olympics, and what is in store for that country in the future, is an incomparable experience. A country that went from $250 per capita income, now pressing $4,000, in a few years approaching even $6,000 and $7,000. Unbelievable experiment, made possible by the United States, first of all by our own intervention during the Korean War to defend the Korean freedom of choice in the future, and then, of course, by our successive and continued presence of more than 40,000 troops in defending the Korean Peninsula against the possible onslaught from the north again. But even Korea is moving in a very interesting way. Growing anti-Americanism of the type that we saw, or the apparent type that we saw during the Olympics, is becoming rife. With a society that is some 70% composed of people under 25 years of age, with no corporate memory, with no real realization, no real feeling for what we did, times are changing. A highly literate population, 99% literate, people with enormous industry and capability, now have opened relations with the Soviet Union in a very interesting way since the Olympics, have opened formal diplomatic relations with Hungary, of all things, driving the neighbors to the north, Pyongyang, the Republic, Democratic People's Republic of Korea, absolutely bonkers. Korea is reaching out around the world as a new and important player on the international scene. Fragile, yes, strong and challenging at the same time. I have more to say about that in just a moment in terms of our reaction to it. But it is a success story. It's a success story just as Reagan foreign policy toward China and Taiwan. It's a success story. There were those who feared that Ronald Reagan couldn't manage the relationship between mainland China and the United States. There were those who feared in 1980 that he would re-recognize diplomatically, lamentably he did not, Taiwan, the Republic of China, or Taiwan. But they thought that the relationship was headed for a sour and a very negative future. In fact, just the opposite happened. When President Reagan came to office, quietly but efficiently, he sent a message to the leaders in Beijing that we would tolerate no more shouting, that no longer would we work on the agenda of Beijing, we would create an American agenda. And all of the fluster, shouting, and the opprobrium and abuse that was coming from then, as we call it, communist China, would be to no avail. The result is that very subtly, very skillfully, the agenda was shifted. A team of players that formulated and then implemented Pacific Basin policy stayed in place for 8 years of the Reagan administration. Clearly one of the most highly qualified teams with a strategic vision that one could possibly imagine. And that brought about not only the full satisfaction of the relationship between the United States and mainland China, which goes on, obviously, in very important ways, but beyond that, nearly every basic defense requirement, no, let me correct that, every basic defense defense requirement of the Republic of China on Taiwan was satisfied and fulfilled before the Reagan administration left office. A list of requirements was presented in 1981. By the time Ronald Reagan left on January 20th of this year, all of those requirements had been fulfilled, including after having denied Taiwan a modern fighter to replace its aging fleet, including the transfer of all of the requisite technology for Taiwan to develop its own indigenous fighter, which was rolled out just a month ago, a gleaming new airplane which will be produced now in Taiwan and may even, hopefully in the future, form part of its own export activities. Very important indeed. With respect to Hong Kong, we had very little input in the arrangements that were made between Mrs. Thatcher and Chinese leaders beginning in 1997. Those of us who travel to Asia see Hong Kong for what it is, a jewel. Whether it will remain a jewel after 1997 when the first People's Liberation Army soldier is stationed on the street corner of downtown central Hong Kong remains to be seen. But for the time being, it remains a very important anthropological financial center for the United States, for our own investment patterns, and of course a very important avenue of access to mainland China for the Chinese themselves. We see now today, in recent days, the reimposition of certain Stalinist-type controls in mainland China, clearly indicating that the Chinese leaders have lost control of the economic revolution that they have permitted through the reintroduction of a certainly limited private enterprise, and in some cases, untrammeled and flourishing private enterprise. Those companies that were contemplating major investments in China will now draw back. And of all the deals, the hundreds of millions of dollars and billions of dollars of deals that have been made, very few of them have actually occurred in China, primarily because of institutionalized corruption, inefficiency, and failure of the Chinese to achieve new standards of quality. So as a result, countries are looking elsewhere. Koreans join Americans, Canadians, and Brits in investing in other countries of Southeast Asia. Taiwan has become the leading investor in the Philippines and in Indonesia. Tiny Taiwan, with its 20 million people, holds the second largest foreign exchange reserves in the world today, some $76 billion, second only to Japan and West Germany. Amazing feat, to be sure. The ASEAN countries, the six ASEAN countries of the Philippines, Malaysia, Indonesia, Thailand, Singapore, and Brunei, constitute a major investment opportunity not only for us and for Europe, but also for the Southeast Asian nations themselves that are more highly developed, including, of course, Japan. The presence of Japan is feared and indeed loathed in Southeast Asia. And the ability of Japan to extend its empire, its financial empire, achieving today by the use of the yen what it was unable to do during World War II by the use of the tank and the bomber and the aircraft carrier, is something that we must watch very carefully. But I suppose that matters little. They've, I think, performed one of the most amazing and systematically successful con jobs on international affairs over the last 40 years. It's nothing at all to do with democracy as we know it. But we may find ourselves in the same boat with our Asian trading partners who are really important to us and represent an extraordinary opportunity. For example, at who's ordering airplanes in the world today? Who's thinking 10, 15, 20 years ahead? It's the airlines of Southeast Asia. They are the ones that know that the requirements that will be put upon them in the future, brought about by their own industry and by their own dedication to free enterprise, always under the mantle of American leadership and protection, offer those amazing opportunities. We may find ourselves in the same boat if Europe of 1992 becomes a reality. Because, in my view, when the walls come down in Europe in 1992, if indeed they do, creating a market of some 330 million people, the walls will go up around Europe to the outside. And we, the Asians, may find ourselves, indeed I would suggest, we'll find ourselves looking from the outside in. The importance, then, of the Pacific Basin relationship with the United States, in strategic terms, grows day by day. If indeed Mr. Gorbachev is successful in decoupling Europe from the United States. And Gerald is exactly right when he points to the problem of the disintegration or the potential disintegration of NATO, as well as the disintegration of the Soviet Empire. If Mr. Gorbachev succeeds in doing that, in separating us from our German allies particularly, and in that he is being singularly successful, he may indeed also attempt to detach us from our Pacific Basin partners. And that indeed would have serious implications. As we know, Gorbachev will meet in a summit meeting with Deng Xiaoping and other Chinese leaders in May of this year. We look upon that as a considerable, shall we say, concern. The question then is, how should we react to the challenge of the Asians whom we need? Can we really afford to bash them? Bashing Asian nations because they are weak and more vulnerable and more likely to accept the bashing than others is a very bad idea indeed. We don't bash Canadians, we don't bash English or French or even the Germans. It's very easy to bash the Japanese. Have you noticed, if you've noticed in recent weeks and months as concern about trade problems mounts in Washington, D.C., the initiatives are always taken against the more weak and the more defenseless countries, such as Taiwan, Korea, Hong Kong, and Singapore, not against Japan. Of course, the fact that Japan does have a modest investment in U.S. Treasury securities and instruments probably in no way influences our opinion in that regard. But Japan also spends, within the United States, $250 million to defend itself. Defend itself through law firms and lobbying firms. I can truthfully confess I have no Japanese clients, so I can tell you about this with a great plomb. They, in fact, have spent a great deal and been enormously successful in defending themselves. The Japanese do not see their relationship with us the same way we see ours with them. The Japanese find us an enormously convenient protector. The Japanese have benefited far more from the relationship with us than we have with them, yet we need them, and we cannot afford to have them decoupled in the same way that any of our European partners might also be decoupled as well. The underlying question is, can the United States compete with those Asian nations that are posing such a severe challenge to us today? The answer is probably not in the long term. We've got to try. They have an ability to organize themselves. They have a sense of doing business that is totally different and distinct from our own. They have a willingness to invest in a market over the long term and to stay the course. They're willing to accept losses for 4 or 5 years that no corporate manager could afford to do today, at least not one trained at Harvard or any other leading business school, because his future is on the line with the quarterly results and certainly the annual results of his corporation, his own promotion, his own future well-being depend on that. The Asian way of doing business, as we've all come to learn, is totally different. Those people believe in team spirit, for whatever it's worth. We wouldn't want to live like the Japanese. We wouldn't want to live in their circumstances or at their scale of living. But what they have achieved, what the Koreans are in the process of achieving, and the Chinese, or Taiwan particularly, and those countries of Southeast Asia are beginning to achieve through teamwork and without regard to individual stardom, are the main concern that we face in the world ahead, the economic world ahead. We must either reform ourselves, reform our own thinking, or face the prospect of being uncompetitive, non-competitive for the long term. And the consequences of being non-competitive will include frustration. And the consequences of frustration will include legislation, and that legislation may well be protections. Our national security objectives in Asia are not as distinct, not as clear-cut as they are in Europe or even in Latin America, our front yard. But our objectives do include trying to block, checkmate, or to match the Soviet Union and its own initiatives in the Pacific Basin. And the Soviet Union clearly is on the march there, throughout the entire region. Our objectives, in terms of national security, are to increase the prosperity and the strength of those countries. Yet that objective may conflict with our own more narrow objectives here in the United States to reform our own competitiveness, and in the absence of being able to reform our own competitiveness and get back on the playing field again, to block the access of those nations to our market, which is a contradictory objective, because to block their access to our markets or to penalize them for being so competitive runs directly counter to the objective of keeping them prosperous and therefore free and therefore a bulwark in our overall national security system and network. The trade retaliation damages that may occur then will have a direct impact on our national security and will impair the ability of the Southeast Asian, Pacific Basin nations to function with us. How we resolve that dilemma is going to be very interesting indeed. Finally, I would say that the real conundrum that we face, the dilemma referred to by Gerald and I'm sure by other speakers here this morning, would be how to demonstrate as thinking conservatives, and that's what we are, and the mainstream conservative American thinking still has an enormous impact on policymaking here and abroad as we know. How are we going to conduct our affairs in such a way that we can be cautious without damaging our allies and still not appear to be against peace? This is a major challenge. I shared at the outset and share today the concerns about the implications of INF. I was aghast and horrified at the initiatives at Reykjavik put forward by President Reagan. But how, today particularly, when Gorbachev and the Soviets are on the march, how do we convey our own dedication to peace through strength without destroying our credibility, our ability even to get heard, to be heard in national debate today? It seems to me to be a very interesting challenge as well. Bush administration has been recently accused by Mr. Gorbachev of dragging its feet on arms reduction, further arms reduction progress. That's not all bad because the Bush administration is undergoing what it calls a strategic policy review that will be to be done and completed before the summit meeting with the NATO partners in May, marking the 40th anniversary of NATO. If the Bush administration is capable of thinking in broad strategic terms, global terms, if it's capable of defining our objectives, it's capable of helping make us competitive again in the world today, and it has most of the elements it needs for a rational policy for the future. It's also going to need a lot of determination, because dealing with the Soviets today and dealing with our Pacific Basin partners is not just a matter of striking a deal. It's not just a matter of deal-making in the classic Washington political sense. It requires deep thought and substance. It requires the kind of substance and determination with which Ronald Reagan came to office. Let's hope that Mr. Bush will have the same success.